This is Maxine Ray conducting an interview for the Civil Rights Project, sponsored by the Kentucky Oral History Commission of the Kentucky Historical Society. I am interviewing Mrs. Thelma Johnson here at her home in Henderson, Kentucky. Today's date is October the 21st, 2000. Now, Mrs. Johnson, will you give me your full name, please?
Thelma Banks Johnson.
Would you tell me when and where were you born?
You know, May the 8th, 1909.
Good. Where were you born then?
Georgia.
Oh, how long have you lived in Henderson?
Came here in 1946.
Okay. Would you give me your parents' name, please?
Mary and Harry Banks.
Mm-hmm. And what is your occupation, or what was your occupation?
It's a home economist, working extension as an extension out of the University of Georgia at one time for 10 years, and also out of the University of Kentucky.
Good. Have you held any other kind of jobs? Any other jobs?
Just ordinary jobs between school and, oh yes, I've worked a lot of places. I worked in restaurants, I've nursed babies, done anything, so I wouldn't have to do it the rest of my life.
Good. Well, how many years did you teach?
An extension, 34 years.
Oh, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about any of your experiences in your teachings?
Well, let's go way back to Georgia.
All right.
We'll go way back and see how old I am. At one time, the government had too much cotton on hand. So they decided that they would give poor people mattresses according to the number in your family. A certain number, you get one mattress, certain number, two mattress, three mattress, so forth. Give it 50 pounds of cotton, the ticket. Now it was up to the extension workers to see that these were done. Now, it was a white home agent, black home agent. Okay. They rented Singer sewing machines. And of course I knew how to take a Singer apart to clean it and oil it and all this kind of stuff. I had charge of showing the women how to make ticks. In other words, we made up some ticks to start with. When a family came in, the man would take the tick. It was already made up. And they would take him out where he got 50 pounds of cotton. They stuffed it in there. And in the meantime, I'm showing the wife how to make a tick to replace the one that she has been given. Okay, now, everything was separate. So naturally the whites came first and got theirs. Okay, very few of them got more than two ticks. Now, they were charging 50 cents, that's for the needle, because a lot of times they, you know, break needles, you know. Okay, mattress is finished and all that, and you go home. Okay, we got through with the whites. Now it's time for the blacks to come in. So the white agents decides that, well, I don't think I'll be here when the blacks come to get this. First thing they did, they upped the price. They went up to a dollar for the needle. Okay, most of the blacks got three mattresses because they had such large families. But that wasn't the biting thing. She brought in a 16-year-old white girl to put her in charge of the project. Okay, now, when I told my black supervisor what had happened. Go ahead and take charge. In other words, she had her there to collect the money, what she had been doing. See, she's been collecting the money while I'm showing them how to do the ticks. So I knew now I got better sense than that. You know, so I just didn't say anything. But we had some teachers. You know, a lot of teachers then were working, getting $30 and $40 a month, and schools closing at 6 months and five, and they were glad to get a little extra money. So they made enough to pay them something. And I remember I had a teacher there playing, and she and this child, this 16-year-old, I don't know what it was about it. I don't know what she wanted to call me. Something they had an argument, something about it. And this white child reported it to this white agent. And she came to me very quietly and said, you know, I suspect it'd be better to get rid of that person because of something she hadn't said. She's a teacher, and I wouldn't want to hurt her on a job. In other words, if you don't get rid of her here, so she doesn't do what that 16-year-old tells, I'm going to see that she loses her job. So I told the girl she quit. Well, those are the kind of things. And yet that same woman, later on, we used to go down to, this was in care facility. We used to go down to Albany. That's just like going on to Evansville College. And we used to drive down to school at night, 2 cars, go down there, teach and study. On the way back, I pulled out to pass a car. And by the time I got almost even, but the car makes a left turn right in front of me. So now I know enough to know to turn and go the way she's going. So I turned and went that way also, and of course she just kind of bounced off the side road down, and we were still there. Okay. All right, we all stopped. I got a carload of teachers, and there's a carload behind us. Well, they all stopped. And that's a little damage. The white woman's car, though. Oh, and she was taller, this, that, and the other. And meantime, other white folks are gathering, you know, and they don't want to hear a Negro dispute a white woman's words, you know. In the meantime, finally, policemen came. The guys were standing around out there talking, and I finally asked them, did I have any protection out there that particular night? And they said, nobody's going to bother anybody. So they finally sent them on away. But the sheriff came. They carried me to jail.
To jail?
Well, yes, to jail. I was not going to agree to fix her car when it wasn't my fault. You see, so I wouldn't agree to fix a car, so nothing he could do but arrest me. But she was charging, you know. So they carried me on to jail, and there was a person in my car who could drive, and I told her to go to no, said, we going with you. The other car went on to town. Okay, they went on down there, and they sat outside the jail. They carried me in there, and I didn't see why I had to lock. He said, I can't sit out here with you all night. I got on my wife. So he put me in the jail, but he didn't put me in a cell. Well, I've been there, and the folks in jail so happy. I said, one colored woman, I knew. She said, she even killed a man. I don't know, my dog. Well, anyway, he went on.
How old were you, Susan? Huh? How old were you?
Oh, I guess I was probably in my 30s, I imagine, you know. Anyway, I'm in jail. Now, the other car goes home. And they told the folk why the other car was not there. They went and got my pastor. They got the pastor of the Baptist church. And they had the mailman. The black mailman that carried mail to whites, and I had his daughter in my car. So they went and got him, and he went and got up some lawyers. There were some lawyers there. I never will forget the name. Ford, father and son. And they had a son who was a lawyer down in that time. He got that man up, and he told him, said, well, you go down there and get my son, and he'll go. See about it. On the way out, I think they took all the money they had taken up in church that Sunday. They carried that with them. And they tell jokes about it. Say they stopped on the top of the hill and bought cigars and all this stuff. And they went, the man's wife who drove my car ran a pool room. And Whiskey Doe, he was the money man in the bunch. And they said he laid that car out. And they came down there. when they got there, they went and got this white lawyer. And he, when the jailer found out who he was, the jailer just gave him the key. The lawyer came and they took me out. They took me on back home. In the meantime, they put the time for the court to meet. Now this is how bad things were. Mm-hmm. When I had to go to court, my lawyer came up from down there to talk to his daddy, you know. And they came by my, I went by the daddy's house. Anyway, I had come from church. And they said, "Now, when you come down there, don't dress like that." It's my lawyer. "Don't dress like that." Said, "Dad, don't dry whole suits in there, skirt in a different fly. Don't be so matched up." Okay, and the next thing they said to do, said, "Get the white agent to come down and sit with me." Okay. Now, this is my lawyer. Don't have any nail polish on. And all of that. And I went down there. She went with me. And I have never, the lawyer that was prosecuting me, he had it made, you know. He didn't have any idea that he was going to lose. So he started out, this nigger woman come running down here, running her mouth, no doubt. Ran over, you know, told me how I did this woman, ran off the road. Just lies. Just unfounded the ladies. And she said, "I know good and well you didn't." And said, things that I said, I didn't say, you know. Oh, but he's just carrying on and he just raved, oh, blah, this, blah, blah, blah. And then my lawyer got up. And he told him, said, "Now I put a lot of trouble in this case, a lot of time in it. Because I knew I had a hard job to follow." And said, "Here's Miss So-and-so, a well-known white woman that everybody knows. And everything, and by the way," he told me, "when they ask you the question, don't say anything that would be amount to calling her a lie. That's what the jury is concerned." He told me all that. Okay, said, "Now I knew I had this fine white woman, and I've had to find this poor nigga girl." My own lawyer had to call me a nigga, but that wasn't the case for him. Mm-hmm. But he got through and he went on to telling and all of that, and see, here's this white woman sitting here, you know, with me and all of that. And she didn't have to go back that afternoon. But anyway, and all the black folks in the town, Banks May, I hadn't married then. Banks May as well go ahead and pay it. He ain't gonna make it. Hey, she can't beat that white woman in court. She might as well go, you know, all this, that, and the other. But I guess I was just honored at that stage. I knew I was not gonna admit to doing that when I didn't do it. But I won the case, he won the case, he won it after all. And everybody's surprised. And the thing about it, when it was estimated what she wanted, enough out of it to buy herself a new car. Mm-hmm. But here's something else that they didn't know. My bosses, my black boss at the state level, I didn't have anything but a car. All of them got mortgage on the car. So if I lost the case, they wouldn't do anything because they'd have to pay him. You know, that's pay off first mortgage. Mm-hmm. So that was that was some of the encounters that you ran across back there, and those are some of the things that happened. And even after integration, there were all kind of smooth things going on for them to still maintain the control, because I can remember right here since I've been in Tennessee. They started work with low-income families. And what they did, they started, they wrote and asked us, specialized areas, what they were getting into before we get to that. What would you like to do? You want to specialize? I've always been interested in foods. My first choice was foods and nutrition. The second choice was home management. Okay. everybody fill this out. When they got through, all the white agents got what they wanted. They gave me low-income families. That wasn't even in the offering. Okay. Well, that didn't bother me because I was working with them anyway. But the point was, when they got ready to sign it out, they made this mistake. They went to the white agents and told them what they got. But when they got ready to tell me what I had, I worked two counties. They made me come to the office so the white agent could hear what they were telling me. And I'm sitting there looking all grown. She's talking about, did you so-and-so? Tell me so-and-so, please. I said, I don't have anything to be pleased about. Well, you will be working with the white men in too. I said, well, I guess there's much since the white woman's going to be working with the black women. Still insane. She realized she'd made a mistake there somewhere. So that afternoon, I had to go down to the other county to let that agent hear what she told me. So when she got down, it really got messed up. I thought that agent down there was so anxious to get me under her wing. Oh, yes, Thelma, you could do that, because you could be working with all of us, because now then you could help me. I said, because I've got some women that have been wanting to study refinishing of furniture, and you could get in there with them and just work and work. Mm-hmm. And the supervisor said, no, Kitty Bess did. No, Kitty. Now, we're not going to make it. And she realized then what it was all going to be like. And she stopped there with that. But then I could see what agents were thinking. They were going to not leave me in a responsibility, so mm-hmm. you could call me to come in there to do anything you wanted me to do. Mm-hmm. You could call me to do anything you wanted me to do. So I didn't say anything. I made up my mind. So when I came home, I got in touch with the state person, and I told her I didn't like the deal they were cooking up for me over here, and I wanted a conference at the state level. She gave it to me. However, she was not able to conduct it because she had a serious accident before the time. And I thought to myself, What is this, an omen? What is this? You know, and I thought, no, I'm going. I prayed over that thing, and I went on anyway, and I had to meet somebody else, you know. And I was telling them that how this integration was going and how they had treated my women. And in other words, I took my women to a meeting, and they went to different departments, but I went to a meeting with the agents. And when the person from the university who knew me as well as you know, she introduced everybody at that meeting but me. I didn't say a word. And when it was over, I told a supervisor out there, I said, I hope my women got better treatment than I got. I said, because they introduced everybody in there but me. And I didn't say anything. So that person that I spoke to went around and trying to find out who had charge of the meeting. Anyway, when I got to the state, I finally got to the state, and the woman in charge listened to what I was saying. And when I told her about how I was treated and not, you can't imagine what she said. She said, well, I imagine that just, she just overlooked you. And I said, how in the world could she overlook me in a room full of white women? Well, that broke up the meeting. You know, everybody just kind of settled down. And finally, they got to the person that had done that. And she was the person that pretended she loved black people so well. And she was not able to tell them why. She said, I certainly did, and I don't know why I did it. Mm-hmm. Well, those are the kind of things you went through, you overlooked, and just then, but you knew deep down underneath there was always that desire to pin you, pin you under. And after I went to another meeting.
This is the meeting at the state
at
level.
At the state level.
Okay, well now this time you're working for the University of Kentucky.
I'm in the University of Kentucky now.
Oh, now what's the two counties that you worked in? Were they in Kentucky?
Yeah, I could be in Henderson. I wouldn't have been in state level.
Okay, Henderson. And what was the other county?
Davis
County.
That's Owensboro.
Yeah.
You see, I worked two counties. There's not enough blacks in one county to warrant having a worker here. And a black man asked for a worker here. The man told him if I ever get another appropriation from there, I'll give it to you, but they had to add Davis County to it. Davis County contributed nothing. I think they finally gave Stanton or some such thing, but the county didn't get anything. It all came from government. See, it's sent to the land-grant college, and it's administered by your local universities.
Uh-huh.
You see, that's happened. Everywhere it's an extension, it's an extension worker, somebody working with 4-H clubs or farmers, it's all out of the land-grant college. But the money comes from.
Okay, I see. But
that's how that was, and of course I was working at the university. Well, now they got all that straightened out, and finally they had it to understand. And then when they got it down to low income families, they still tried to maneuver it so the person that had foods and nutrition would have some say. So I sat there and listened and played crazy. Until they got through. And I said, well now, you say I'm working with low income families. I said, now, when you talk about a person with foods and nutrients, where does that leave me when I'm working with low income families? I made them spell that out, take her out of that. But you see, what they wanted to do, somehow they kind of wanted me to kind of report to her, well, she would have incorporated it into what she was
to
doing.
Her report.
And I didn't mean to do that. So they finally got outright, they cut it loose. It was outright, and I ended up being
breaking the tape for a telephone call as Cherie Smith is here, and she will be asking questions also. Now, we were talking about you getting your position as the director of the food and nutrition.
Yes. It ended up, all of the persons in my area who worked with low-income families sent their reports to me, and I sent them in. Mm-hmm. Now, I had even a problem there with my supervisor. It was easily ended because I'd learned then that I was going to tell it if there was a fault. And that was because of some of the workers. They sent out lots of reports. They sent out a lot of reports that had to be made and sent in. And I was having a meeting in Owensboro with those workers down there. And by the way, there were around 32 or 33 of them at one time that I had charge of. But anyway, they didn't want to make the reports. So I saw them sneaking around talking to him because he was white, you know. He didn't want to make the reports. So I came back with reports and he said, what about all these reports? I said, well, my supervisor said that. Well, they didn't tell me that they had to be made, and we're not going to make them. And just don't make them. We're not going to make them. I said, okay. I knew they had to be made. I came home, threw them in the filing cabinet, about my business. 2 or 3 days, the university was calling about those reports. And I told them what happened. Well, now they just got to be in. They just begged me. I had to go and get to work, and I had to do it backwards, you see, and that fixed them. They found out they had to do them anyway. And if they'd done them when they were supposed to, they wouldn't have had to do a lot of backtracking. But we had to do all that, and I got them in. And they got him told. Because he came back and apologized. We had no more problems with him. We kept him out of sight then because he was interfering with what we was doing. But the point was, he wanted to think he was the biggest guy. But it did end up that was the way it was, and I ended up working with low-income families, but at that time we went into the homes because they said we were doing it the wrong way.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I was doing when I retired.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the schools you went to, schools you attended?
Yes, yeah, so many of them. Mm-hmm. Now that I started in Georgia, the school I went to was out of existence, man. Mm-hmm. And I went to, I got a degree from Ohio State University. I also studied some classes over at Evansville, just keeping up. Mm-hmm. And then there were other classes. I studied summer session at Cornell and at the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I believe those are all, because I told you, Ben got going to Auburn State earlier, so those schools, mm-hmm. Auburn State's still there. But I believe those are all.
Why did you become a teacher?
When I was little, the only people we came in contact with in the family was the preacher and the teacher. And those were the people I had to look to. I looked up to teachers. So I guess it just started there. I just always wanted to be a teacher because that was a woman that I saw doing something. And as I got older, that was about all a woman could get into out of ordinary work was teaching. Men were carrying mail, that was it, you know, other than working for themselves. But that was seemed to have been the only thing to do. It looked like I just always wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. And I kept studying. I still study. It's just a habit. Mm-hmm. And I just can't have it. If I see something that's useful, I'm grabbing it. I thought, well, I never use this. Why did I grab it? You know, but mm-hmm. it's just, I don't know. I just, mm-hmm. teachers were folks I looked up to, and I just wanted to be like them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then I understand that you started the first 4-H club here in Henderson?
Started it because I was first black extension worker here.
Oh, uh-huh.
I first started black 4-H club because I was the first black worker here, you know. Uh-huh. But there were white workers here that had them. And see, I eventually even lost them when they integrated. They turned the 4-H over to the white workers and they finally drifted out of it altogether.
So this was not like a where the 4-H is connected with any of the schools or just
no,
just
that's
through the
part
extension
of the extension.
Agent.
You see, uh-huh. Extension agents the only one could organize a 4-H club, and that was to say, and while I worked with the homemakers and the 4-Hers, I organized. Yes, I met them at school because that's where I saw them. But now in Georgia, I could work with them at schools, but not in Kentucky. Oh. Kentucky, you work through leaders. See, you can organize there, but you couldn't, your leaders worked with them outside, and they had a lot of people that, adults who worked with them, some worked with them at home, and families, and a lot of teachers worked with them outside, you know, the teachers would teach them, well, they would preside over the meetings, even though the series I taught them, I teach them parliamentary procedures, all those kind of things, mm-hmm. how to conduct a meeting and all that. And if they conducted a meeting and I wasn't there, the teacher would oversee, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But no, and that was one reason it wasn't, as 4-H work for blacks was not as successful in Kentucky as it was in Georgia because of the way they operated. Now, if you couldn't find black persons at the time to teach them after they're out of school, you see, they had no leadership. I had to do it. And if I could catch them around, that made it harder to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, now tell me about Human Rights Commission. Are you a member of the Human Rights Commission, or did you start?
I served as chairman of the Human Rights. I was on it mm-hmm. in the beginning. And I'm trying to think, I don't remember. It had a mixture of black and white, of course. And I think I was secretary for a while, and eventually I did serve as chairman of the Human Rights Commission for a couple of years, because I remember when it was turned over to me, I'm trying to think.
Do you remember the year it was turned over to you?
I don't want to go back and find records and all of that. But Galen Martin was it? He used to come here a lot from the state.
Now, we were talking about the Human Rights Commission.
Yeah, and I was chairman of it. Anytime anything came to us for correction, we could do nothing about it. We always had to refer it to the state. Somebody else had to come in. We couldn't handle a thing. We didn't handle a thing locally. So I don't know. They always sent somebody, or it got sent away, and it was never, you know, done. It was kind of pushed aside. We could never give anybody. If anybody came to us with something, nothing we could do about it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't handle it locally. Rev Bell was probably a member. We could handle things locally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I understand that you got a plaque for the Civil Rights Hall of Fame in the. Was honored like that. You will tell me a little about that?
Well, Mr. Platt sent in information of what I had done, and he's responsible for my
award.
Yeah, well, I think, what do they call that? Being nominated. He nominated. He was responsible. I guess I'm telling you the truth. I don't believe we don't have a Human Rights Commission out here. I don't believe so.
Right.
But this was done, I think, through the NAACP, I imagine. Mm-hmm. The nomination came from him to him because that information he had, you know, already fairly easy to get. And I wasn't that sure, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize they'd recognize you for being nominated. I just thought you were nominated and you lost it. It's the end of that. Mm-hmm. I was surprised when he brought this back. But it seems that everybody who was nominated received that same mm-hmm. recognition.
Do you belong to the NAACP or is the
I see what that means up there.
You've got a lot of plaques.
Yeah, but look at the last one.
This one?
What does it say?
In grateful appreciation for your generous contribution of $1,000.
Yeah, that means you're above life members.
Oh.
That's a Golden Heritage Life member. That's as far as you can go.
Oh.
I can't go any further. So you can see why the NAACP mm-hmm. was pushing for. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the NAACP began years ago, did you all have very many racial problems to confront then when you first started?
Listen, I don't know when, I'm pretty sure, I don't know. I probably joined it here. Well, when I joined it, there were not too many life members. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered that a white man here was a life member, I got pushing it. And I pushed it up so percentage-wise, Henderson got more life members, and they got a lot of them life members. And then after that, they kept sending. I thought when you're a life member, probably they worrying you for money. And then there came this Golden Heritage. I said, well, I'm going to pay that and I'm going to be through issuing money. Because they'll come to find out how they messed it up. You remember when they changed heads not long ago, one person started donating. They got rid of that one and got a different one now. So now I'm a Golden Heritage Life member of NAACP. But I was grown, of course, when I donated the ACP naturally.
Well, do you...
Because come to think about it, we're just about the same age, aren't we?
Oh, well, yes.
NAACP.
You and the NAACP are just about the same age.
So I couldn't have started with...
Well, no, I mean, I just thought maybe you might have started with this particular chapter here. You know, maybe started up this
particular... I didn't start this chapter. No, I didn't start any here, chapter. Henderson. I joined the chapter. Uh-huh. I don't know who's responsible for starting. You know, Lamar? I don't know who started the first NAACP chapter. I just don't know. I haven't the slightest idea.
Okay, well, let me ask you a little bit about your church life. Do you go to church?
She is the church.
No, I'm not. All my life I've gone to church.
Okay. Do you belong to any of the church organizations or anything?
I'm the treasurer of a missionary group, mm-hmm. so circle. Well, I've been in a lot of things at church.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of drives, made a lot of money mm-hmm. coming to that church through things, ideas that I gave them and carried them out,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of your church?
Norris Chapel Baptist Church. Good. But I was reared in the Methodist Church. Uh-huh. I didn't go in there until I was grown. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was no AME church here. And I got tired of going to Evansville, and I knew no point in going over there until I'm too old and then joining over here. So I just joined. I had a lot of friends in the Baptist Church, so I joined the Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. And of course I had to be immersed. I had to be in, so I was baptized into Norris Chapel mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Baptist Church, but I was good and grown. And I've been there working ever since.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any kind of racial prejudices or anything that you faced in any of the stores or around here in Henderson?
In Henderson.
Yes, right here in Henderson. Was there any kind of negative responses to you maybe going into stores or trying to purchase something? Or?
Well, when I first came here, there was a store, I think of the name of it now, where it's the most expensive store in town where folks went, bought the fine things.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Was it the Bones?
Yeah, it's the name of Bones. And a friend of mine who traded there a lot, I met him in the room or somebody, went, go into Bones and open up your account. Go to Bones, open up your account. So I went strolling into Bones. And when I went in, I said, I would like to speak to someone about opening an account. So they sent me back, pointed me to the man, I guess it's Bones himself. And when I went back and said to him, I was interested in, we're not opening a new account. We're not opening a new account. I said, thank you. I walked right on out. I went two doors away to man's anyway. And I walked in there and I said, I wanted to see about opening up an account. They said, yes, well. And they did ask who I was. And I told them I'd just come to town and who I was working for, and so forth and so on, and I don't know, I was talking to him, or who that was, it? Okay, open up an account, sell $100, sell all you want. You know how man was, you know. So I opened up an account, a different story altogether. The first man looked at my color, he didn't even want to know my name. So that's the only time that I really noticed anything, because it wasn't that many stores, you know, to go into, you know. Mm-hmm. But
Segregation here in integration came with like a smooth transition here in Henderson. Was there any marches or sit-ins?
Oh, they were here, but I couldn't participate in them.
Okay.
This is what I'm telling you.
Yeah,
yeah, they were here.
Because you worked for the government.
But I couldn't. No, they didn't allow you to. They didn't even allow you to run public office then. But now. You can, but at the time I was in there, all you could do was vote, but you couldn't express yourself because you couldn't advertise. If I'm going to cook, I can't. You have Crisco and a Crisco can, because the other company can tell the government you're advertising for Crisco.
Yeah.
You understand that?
Yeah.
So I couldn't march, I couldn't sit, I couldn't do anything.
Well, what did you think when you saw that kind of stuff on TV or heard about it, like all the sit-ins?
Well, I knew what it was going on here. But I knew with the job I had, if I wanted the job, I didn't sit. And I needed the job more than I needed to sit.
A lot of people didn't think it was going to accomplish much. What did you think?
I must have thought it was going to accomplish. I paid for other folks to go to Franklin. I furnished money for things that I couldn't do. Because I had to be with the movement, you know. I had to be with it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I had to live also.
And
so I contributed money. The people were going to Frankfurt. I paid the way for somebody who couldn't afford to pay to go up there to do that.
To demonstrate.
Yeah.
Oh.
See, Anthony knows about that because he was head of it, you see. But I give it him. But he wasn't going around yelling out to everybody, you know, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it did, but I couldn't do that. Because the very folk I did it for, I would say, well, you're a fool to give up your job to do it. And I knew that too.
What year did you get married?
Oh my goodness. I was good and grown then, too. Oh, my first marriage ended in divorce. And I got married in, let's see. I'm trying to think, when did I marry Stalin? I have to go back and get the license. I forget all that stuff. But,
Mr. Johnson, when did you marry
Mr.
Johnson?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think of now. Because I left here. Married him before I left, and then came back and got the job right back. Because I was leaving him. See, I'm in Virginia.
Because you're from Georgia.
Yeah, and I went back to Georgia. I did go back. I signed a contract and went back. And before I left, married him. But I had to go fulfill that contract. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And transferred back, got the job back here. Because the person that fought me didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I got there and married, I reapplied to come back to work anywhere in the state, to get back in the state. And in the meantime, I got the same place back. Transferred back and forth, didn't have a break in service either way. But, let's see, 60, it had been 50s. But we built this house in 62. And we had to marry in the 50s, probably in 52, somewhere around there when we were married. Because we stayed in his house. We stayed up on 7th Street.
So he's from Henderson?
Oh, yeah. I was born there.
Exactly.
Yeah, he was born. Yeah, I'm sure he was. Yeah. He was born there in Henderson. I'm sure he was.
What was your husband's name?
Stalin.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Did you hold any kind of city offices or anything here in Henderson?
Ran for the Board of Education, that's all.
Uh-huh. Were you elected to it?
Yeah.
Oh, good. How many years did you serve on that?
Served 8 years. You see, a term was 4 years.
Oh, so you
And I ran a second term. Didn't run a third term. Mm-hmm. And I was on that 8 years. I was chairperson for 4 years.
Did you run into any kind of racial prejudices while you served on that?
They're a nasty one.
Oh.
One time, not from the people I was working with. You were seated in a U, so to speak, and in the curve up there, the superintendent with his secretary, and the chairperson sat. Well, I think there was a white person here. I was here and another white person on the right. Anyway, someone came and your name was in front of you. Some white guy came in there to get an easement for something. And he said what he wanted to do, and he went around. I guess he spoke to everybody, and he went around except me. Whatever he did, he looked over me just completely, and got around and called names, did everything. Something he did though that made it know that he was not counting me at all, whatever it was. So they got ready to look at, you'd have to go up to see the plans that he put down in front of the superintendent. But he had said something, he had addressed them some way or another, but he didn't recognize me at all. So when they all got up to go and look, I just still sat there and stayed right where I was. I stayed right in my seat. And the chairman of the board didn't know what to do, because I guess he was pretty much like the one that was there. And I still sat there. I thought, well, I'm not here, so why should I move? And everybody heard a pin fall out there. Everybody got up and went up there and got sitting down. Got so there, finally, the superintendent took over and told him who I was and whatnot, and I think he then backed up out what he said, but anyway, he picked the record, and I said, well, I won't be as big a fool as he was. So I thought, I said, well, now, I've got a closed mind then. But I got up and went on up there and stood, but everybody, I'm sure, knew I had a closed mind, but I just went on up there and stood. That was one thing. And the other thing was, now, I was the first black elected to public office. But somehow it was maneuvered so that I was not publicly sworn in.
Oh, you weren't?
They had me sworn in chambers. The person who was elected along with me was not even there. I was sworn in chambers. Okay. That was all right. Went on. And I guess, and you see, every 2 years, you see, they don't change the board all the same. So when it got time, they elected two. I went in when they elected two. Well, the next time, they were going to elect three. Okay, they elected three persons. Okay, when they were elected, first night, here comes the judge out in his robe. She's still sheriff at the time, by the way. Because I brought her into it. He came out in his robe and swore them in and presented them with a certificate. And I sat there, I never felt so much like crying. And he got through. I said, I didn't get a certificate when I was sworn in. And, I don't know what he said. He said, but I'll issue one. And I said, well, just give it to the sheriff, because you knew it. I just told him to send it to me by her. Uh-huh. Instead, he comes out here. If you'll notice it up there, it shows that it wasn't done when it should have been done. But he came out here himself and went through it again. But you see, that was the difference. You see, they came out there, they got pictures all in the paper, him out there swear, and didn't even give me a certificate. I was supposed to have one. I suppose those were the teachers, everybody was fine, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody's fine. They invited me out. I never got invited so much to their classes to talk to them, and you know. I was very well received by the paid personnel, yeah. Very well. And I surprised the superintendent. Well, he came to the meeting, you know, where they interviewed all of us, you know, how they call you and interview us, you know, and I ran against a white doctor, by the way. And he was so sure that he was going in, he didn't even show up where they did the interviewing. I mean, by the newspapers. I mean, they had clippings of everything. Anyway, the superintendent asked to come and came in. And of course, he said, I'm perfectly frank, he said that he would naturally be voting for the lawyer. He said, because he's responsible for my being in town. Well, you know, that's okay. That's all right with me. And I asked him some questions, too, but we got along all right. But the meantime, that was all well and good. That was all right. But anyway, I defeated the doctor, by the way. But anyway, when we got in, these three people who came in, there was a feeling that those two young men were in there to get the superintendent because of something that happened to one of his father when they integrated the systems, how they maneuvered, you know, around and all of that. And but you see, I wasn't in there to get even with anybody. I was in there to serve everybody. And I didn't take sides. And the first thing, you see, this superintendent wanted to do the folks made me understand that I let them know he was going to get rid of a man without giving any reason. I don't know what it was now. I didn't know the man. The man had gotten good report every year as being a good a principal. But he wanted to move him from there. It was a promotion, but he didn't want to move. The people didn't want him to move, so he figured there's something wrong. And so what they did that night, what they did, they put it all together. They put it in the thing for you to vote on. And this is the first time I've had to vote in a school board meeting. They put in there to rehire all the teachers, move this man, and do some other things, all those things. And they put it up there. Shit, I thought I'm gonna be silly now. They put it up there going, I said, Mr. Chairman, I had to vote on all that together. I knew it, didn't you? But I said, he said, oh, no, Fee, don't want to. I said, well, pull that Leffler mat out of there. Because you see, if I vote yes, I'm moving a man, the school doesn't want to move, and they haven't given a reason. If I vote no, I'm voting against all the teachers. So they pulled it out. And when I said that, I saw somebody winking at her window and good, so she not food at all. I look at people, and I just looked around and I could see that they knew what was happening and I had defeated what was happening. Mm-hmm. So they had to pull it out. And so they pulled it out. And then they had to make a motion. So one man said, well, I offer a motion to do this. Okay, that went right on through. Well, it got back down to this one person. I'm not going to say a thing. I'm going to sit there and listen. Because I didn't offer the motion for it to be done. And one man who's in that man's district said, well, I guess the only way we're going to get this over with is to make a motion. And he offered the motion that the man be moved. And you had to, vote for. And I voted no. And of course, lost only one vote, So the man was moved, but it was clearly understood that the man from his own district voted for him to be moved, and he lost. I didn't even know the man, didn't know him from Adam. But the point was, they knew I wasn't in there for any particular faction, and I was in there for everybody else. So that was about the only problem I had, that because they realized from then I was going to ask. If I didn't understand it, I was going to ask it. If I didn't believe it, I was going to vote against it. Mm-hmm. And they knew that, so that was that. Mm-hmm. They had no problems.
Well, you said you built your house back in the 60s.
When you 62.
62. Mm-hmm. Did you, when you built in this neighborhood, was it a mixed neighborhood or was it an all-black neighborhood?
No, it's I guess it's always been mixed. Uh-huh. Because white woman owned the house next door when I bought mm-hmm. this one. Mm-hmm. She had an outside toilet. Mm-hmm. She didn't build bathrooms when we built this house. And her daddy made a move. Her daddy made a move for me to move in another poor neighborhood after we moved here. Yeah, white woman lived there. And let's see, where else did whites live? There was nobody here. This was a vacant lot.
Oh, uh-huh.
In fact, that was a vacant lot, mm-hmm. but both of them were vacant. But I think whites probably live from here up. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about where the Carters live now. They've always lived there since mm-hmm. I've been there, but mm-hmm. whites have lived. It's always been there.
Well, when you came into the neighborhood, did you face any kind of racial prejudice? Did they try to keep you from moving in?
No. That's why we built here.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to go through that. If I'd gone out into another neighborhood, I might have faced something. Mm-hmm. And we were old, too old to be fooling with it, because young people put up with it, and they went on out there. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, we wouldn't have built here, but mm-hmm. the point was, we wanted to leave where we were. Mm-hmm. And we had to get lots where we could find them. Mm-hmm. And some people, black people that owned lots, we would have bought them, but wouldn't sell it. Mm-hmm. City came along and took it later anyway. So they didn't gain anything by not mm-hmm. selling to us, but well, this was the only place we could find a lot. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's no objection to it. Although, I'm trying to think, what was it? There was something in the deed that somebody didn't understand, because this white woman went down to be sure we were going to build a dwelling house here, and since she had no objections to that, but no. This was, I don't know, because the Harleys, the blacks have always lived down there, haven't they? I guess, on the other side of the church. Mm-hmm. I guess there have always been blacks here. Mm-hmm. But there have been whites, too. Mm-hmm. But that was, that's left by true all over Henderson, I guess, except in maybe certain places. Mm-hmm. Whites have always been able to live where they wanted to live, whether it's black or
Do you think that the race relations in Henderson now has changed from the time when you first come here? Do you think it's any better? Or?
Oh yeah, I think it's better. Mm-hmm. I think it's better.
Yeah. Well, Ms. Johnson, can I ask you, do you vote? You don't have to answer any questions. I don't.
You know I vote.
Yes.
I wouldn't have.
You wouldn't have got your jobs if you hadn't voted. Yes. Yes. I understand.
I'm a Democrat. I don't mind telling that. That doesn't mean that I believe in every person on the panel. That, you know.
Now, when you were an extension agent and you would go into people's homes, what exactly would you teach them or help them with?
What they wanted help with. That was why they sent it down. When the homemakers program, homemakers would come in. And when first they organized a club, they had to organize a club first and tell them what it was all about. And you had food leaders, clothing leaders, home management leaders. Now, if the club decided, well, we're going to study clothing this time, well, you send your clothing leaders in. And they would say, what do you want to learn? They'd tell me what they wanted to learn. And we'd make up the program. And that's what we would teach when we would go there. Okay. Now, we found out that there were people in there. Even though we had foods lesson, I was teaching them using proper measuring cups, the proper measuring spoons, the proper utensils and everything, which they didn't have at home.
Oh.
And we were teaching them, and it wasn't meeting their needs. Mm-hmm. And they really found that out when this whole world got centered on low-income families. Mm-hmm. And I found out I was teaching somebody, stock this on the middle rack, and they didn't even have a rack in the stove.
Oh.
See, that put it right down there. We were using commodities. They were, they were sending out, what it was, meal. Now everybody's crazy about yellow meal. Then folks come to find out they're putting it down for the kids to play and play and all that kind of stuff. And they thought it was nothing. It was bad, but it was still none better meal than meat. And they thought, it wasn't good stuff, but it was. But we couldn't put the names, they couldn't put the names on it, they were giving it away. Mm-hmm. But when we got into teaching, I went into your house, she wants to learn the first place, a woman wanted to learn how to make cookies, peanut butter cookies, like they served at school. Her children would come home crazy, and they wouldn't eat hers. Well, I had to go in and show her how to make peanut butter cookies in her stove. When I went in there, I wasn't too sure what I was stepping on sometimes.
Oh.
Whether I was stepping on a rotten potato or something else. Well, I looked over in the corner, and there were all these dirty clothes piled up on a washing machine. I wonder why I didn't she wash. And then when I asked for some water, she got a bucket and went out of the house and went down where she lived to a common speaker. And I said, well, my Lord, no wonder she doesn't wash, need a washing machine. She's got to bring water up here in a bucket. And you can see why my teaching wasn't doing her any good. Okay, we got up there. Well, I found out she didn't have everything that she needed. And guess what she was doing with her flour? Well, she was opening it, on the back of the stove, cutting it open. The bugs were everywhere, so I went and got people to save me their 3-pound coffee cans and those kind of things and showed her how to make canisters to make, to put her flour in her sugar.
This is Maxine Ray. While replacing the tape, Mrs. Johnson, who is over 95 years old, decided that she did not want to speak anymore. or to answer any more questions. So this is the end of her interview.